Introducing Mr. Geoffrey Hodson, who has taken for his title Through the Gateway of Death. Friends, Mr. Geoffrey Hodson.
The subject of the life after death can scarcely fail to be of the greatest interest and importance to every one of us. For who is there among us who has not been called upon to experience the pain of bereavement, felt a desire to know where the loved ones have gone, and something of the conditions of the life after death into which they have entered, and, for that matter, upon which we must all embark when our time comes, as one day inevitably it must. The long, mysterious exodus of death, as it has been called, is in consequence a subject which we do very well to consider, I think. Immediately we do so, many questions present themselves to our minds. For example, does death bring the extinction of human identity? Were the deceased aware of the immediate approach of death? Were they conscious of the process of dying? How is the life after death entered? To what conditions does the soul awaken after death? Is there continuity of personality with memory, affection, sympathy, and continued interests? Is there time there, business, work, pressure, or is one free of all these in the life after death? May we hope for reunion, as we all do? Reunion with those we have loved who have passed away? What should we offer to death? Can one make plans for one's life after the death of the body? These surely are some very natural questions, and theosophy answers them very clearly and distinctly and without any attempt at evasion. Theosophy therefore possesses a special power to console the bereaved and to illumine those who seek knowledge about the life after death. Theosophy also has the power to console because it affirms most positively that there is a life beyond the grave, that the body alone dies, whilst the immortal Son of God, the true spiritual self of man, lives on and unfolds eternally. Theosophy affirms the great teaching in the Apocrypha, which I think gives the true solution to the problem of life after death. In the Wisdom of Solomon, we read, "For God created man for immortality and made him the image of his own eternity." A Hindu scripture affirms the same truth, and I quote from a translation by a great English poet. He called it the Song Celestial, and he was Sir Edwin Arnold. He translated the Bhagavad Gita, and amongst his verses one finds these beautiful words: "Never the spirit was born, the spirit shall cease to be never. Never was time, it was not. End and beginning are dreams. Birthless and deathless and changeless remaineth the spirit forever. Death hath not touched it at all, dead though the house of it seems. There, I believe, if we can receive it, is the real answer to the question as to whether life continues after death. Theosophy teaches that the spiritual soul of man, his true divine self, is indeed undying, eternal, indestructible. Furthermore, this undying soul of man is evolving to perfection through the experiences of many lives on earth. It is only the body which dies. Really, we do need to remember that, those of us who are bereaved and who ourselves may be facing death. It is only the body which dies, and not the true self of man at all. For that is the real individuality behind the bodily veil. There, then, is the answer to the first of our questions. Theosophy has power to illumine because it shows how man may know for himself, while still on earth, may know the facts of the life beyond the grave. For Theosophy teaches that there resides in man a faculty by means of which the veil, hiding the invisible worlds from our sight, may be rent asunder, and the facts and the phenomena of that inner world, the conditions of life in it, may be seen, investigated, and understood. If the existence of such a faculty of extended vision could be granted, I don't mean the negative psychism of the entranced medium, I mean a positive, trained power, used under the control of the will, just as is physical vision. If you could grant the existence of such a faculty, and of men and women who possess it, then let us assume that we are in the chamber of death, watching with the seeing eye the transition from this world to the next of someone whose body is dying from old age or disease. What shall we see? At once we will discover the answer to that second question. Were the deceased conscious of the immediate approach of death? The answer is generally no. The failure of the supply of blood and so of oxygen to the brain brings on unconsciousness, a process which is just like falling asleep. Even if there had been suffering at the near approach of death, that suffering ceases before the end. What, then, shall we see as the process of dying is directly observed? Let me suggest. As the hour of dissolution approaches, we shall see the life forces of the body being withdrawn from the extremities and centered in the heart, there to be visible to us as glowing golden light. After this, sensation in the lower limbs is greatly diminished. Then, as death draws still nearer, the life forces are withdrawn still further into the middle of the head, the third ventricle of the brain, which is regarded as the seat of consciousness during physical life. A dying person may or may not still be physically conscious. If unconscious in a coma, which often precedes death, then he will be visible to clairvoyant sight out of the body in his superphysical vehicle. I haven't time to describe this very much to you, but I can say that it is built of much finer matter than the ether of the physical world, and in outline it resembles almost exactly the physical body. It is, in fact, its counterpart. It differs in appearance from the physical in that the substance of which it is built is self-luminous, so that it glows as if lighted from within, and it is surrounded by an atmosphere or aura which is visible as light in constantly changing colors. This aura will also be visible round the dying person, who, physically unconscious, is then outside of his physical body, floating just above it, but still joined to it by a stream of flowing forces which shine with a delicate silvery light. This current flows between the heads of the physical and the superphysical bodies, connecting them, as it were. So long as this stream of energy continues to flow, there is always the possibility of physical reawakening. Once it is broken, however, as it is at the moment of death, then there is no longer any possibility of a return. But you might say there are well-known cases of such return. Yes, but those cases of apparent resuscitation are in reality only reawakenings into bodies that were not really dead. This is described also in the Bible, where we read, Ecclesiastes chapter 12 verses 6 and 7, or ever the silver cord be loosed, or the golden bowl be broken, or the pitcher be broken at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God who gave it. As long then as that silver cord is intact, the dying person may return temporarily to his body. He may open his eyes, see some of the phenomena of the next world, make reference to people and colors and light not physically present. This not infrequently happens. When, however, the actual moment of death arrives, then the silver cord is seen to break, and the man himself to rise as though released from some pull of the body. Although I'm not absolutely certain about this, I'm inclined to think that the exact moment of death for each one of us is fixed fairly precisely. Whether this is so or not, the moment comes. The silver cord, as I've just said, breaks. The man is free of his body and can awaken in it no more. The signs of death then appear in it. Its work is done. Then what happens? In nearly all cases, man is unconscious of dying, as he is also unconscious of falling asleep. He passes away, as it were, upon a sigh, from this world to the next. That answers another of those questions, doesn't it? The deceased is generally engaged in a process of review, in which the events of the life just closed pass before the mind's eye in clear perspective. He or she sees causes and their effects, successes and their results, failures and their outworkings. These are seen and correlated. Now, Theosophy teaches also that this process of the review is very important, because from it there is distilled a certain wisdom, understanding, the fruitage of the life just drawn to a close. It is for this reason that we should mentally, emotionally, and physically be as quiet as we can in the chamber of death. If we don't, then by an excess of grief we might disturb the loved one in this important review. Remember, he or she is now living in the subtler body, the body of feeling, and is therefore highly sensitive to the forces of thought and emotion. Calmly then, and with self-control, our thoughts should rightly be turned in love towards them, and in blessing and aspiration or prayer for their progress inwards to the inner worlds and the spiritual source. In Theosophy we are taught to dwell not so much upon our own great loss, natural and upon the great gain of those who are freed from the physical body and its limitations, when once its valuable work is done and not before. Now let us follow the deceased still further. The review, we assume, is ended. After that there generally follows a period of complete unconsciousness, which may last from 36 to 48 hours, varying with different people. Then an awakening occurs, and the deceased, sometimes all unaware of what has happened, metaphorically looks about him. In many cases, some friend or relative is awaiting him. Or if he has none such to welcome him, then some member of the great band of helpers, whose work it is in the invisible worlds to greet newcomers, come forward to receive them. Such helpers, I may say, are members of a highly trained band of servers deputed to this particular work of assisting new arrivals. Then they welcome newcomers, explain the change, and if necessary, help them to settle down as comfortably as possible. Few, if any, in these days enter that world without some hand being outstretched to welcome and to assist them in the early stages. And that is the theosophical answer to the question, how is the life after death entered? Now we'll consider the nature of that life, and I'm going straight away to say something which may perhaps be difficult to believe. Since, however, I know personally that it is true and is of great importance, I'm going to state it before you. It's this. The world to which our friends have gone, and to which we will all go when our time comes, is no strange land. How can that be? Because we go there every night whilst our physical body sleeps. Sleep has aptly and truly been called the twin brother of death. The difference between sleep and death lies in the fact that in sleep, that silver cord of which I spoke, which links us to the body, is not broken, but in death, the cord is broken, and as we then have no link with the physical body, we can return to it no more. Now the next general principle which I wish to advance. It is that the conditions in which a person finds themselves after death, those conditions depend largely upon his temperament, upon the nature of the life he has led on the physical plane, and upon his outlook, as it were, his character. We each see the world around us through the windows of our temperament. That's true here, isn't it? But it's still more so true in the subtler matter of the super-physical worlds. The sunny-natured, friendly individual awakens after death to a sunny, friendly world, whilst the gloomy, self-centered hypochondriac may awaken to a dull, gloomy, and somewhat lonely world. Not because that world is lonely, but because the self-centered individual doesn't inspire and is unable to give friendship. Happily, the pain, the boredom, and the isolation which such people have unconsciously created for themselves spur them into changing their attitude towards life. Now that question of whether there is work and pressure there. The answer is no, there is not. The businessman, for the first few days after his passing, does tend to gravitate by force of habit to his old business surroundings and premises, perhaps. But, of course, he soon finds that he cannot affect his colleagues. They don't respond to his presence or to his thoughts. They don't even know that he is with them. Except, of course, in the case of very sensitive and what we call psychic people, they sometimes feel the presence of the deceased. Happily, however, the wider interests and greater freedom of the new life in the inner worlds, the responsive and buoyant body he is now using, and his realization that the main causes of business do not obtain in the superphysical worlds, all these soon draw the individual away from his old physical preoccupations. Not, of course, from his loved ones or his love for them. Those continue. But the life after death can indeed be the beginning of a most wonderful freedom. For the grinding business necessities, which doubtless for our own good keep us busy here and tend to chain our thoughts and feelings to material things, these no longer exist after the body with its necessities has been laid aside. Take food, for example. This is one of the principal causes of business and personal effort in this physical world. But it ceases to have any significance in the life after death, for all the nourishment our subtle bodies need is absorbed automatically from the atmosphere. Food, consequently, is not a source of business activity and pressure in the inner worlds. Clothing, too, is made by thought. Does that seem strange? It need not, for the matter of all the superphysical worlds responds instantly to thought. To think of oneself as clothed is to be clothed, whilst one finds people dressed in various modes of attire to which they've been accustomed in consequence. Transportation doesn't depend upon the labors of others. In the superphysical worlds, we move thought-impelled. To think of oneself in a place is to move to that place, swiftly or slowly at will, and by a rather delightful floating motion, something like flying. I expect you've dreamt of it, haven't you? And such dreams have a truth in them, you know. Dreams of the body as light and easily elevated, or as gliding gently or swiftly through the air, can be memories of the normal mode of progression in the world of the life after death. Then there is shelter, isn't there? Housing, for instance. That's another of the great sources of business and human effort and pressure in this physical life, isn't it? But then the same rule applies. Forms are created by thought in the next world, and there are, as here, people who gather together in thought forms of houses and cities. These are perfectly real to them, but they are seen by the investigator to be only thought forms. Of course, privacy is needed in the after-death life just as it's needed here on Earth, but not shelter from the climate. For our adverse climatic conditions are not reproduced there. So we see that life in this world after death can be as varied and fascinating as life on this earth, and it is free. Not only is there an almost endless variety of activities from which to choose, but each activity can be pursued further and for a longer period of time than on earth, where certain pressing necessities make their demands, as we know only too well. There are in the invisible worlds, for instance, not only centers of child life and services to be rendered to the newcomer and for those in need, but in addition all the normal healthy mental activities of human beings seeking greater light and joy and expansion along the lines of knowledge, love and beauty. All these are available. There are also in the early stages of life after death opportunities for religious life. If one entered a church in that world, one would find that religion elevates the worshipper to far greater heights than are usually attained on earth. This is partly because the objects of worship are visible, being thought created, and partly because emotion there is purer and more powerful. At the east end of such a church, one might say, there will be not so much the symbols and stained glass windows as living beings, the thought forms of the great saviors of the world, or of the saints or the angelic host. And these figures created by human thought and adoration are used as living representatives into which their great originals can pour some of their love and consciousness in response to the worship. These forms then can be used as channels for the outpouring of blessing and power, as indeed they are. And you will realize that since all this is visible to the worshipper there, religious services can evoke a fervor and a depth of response rather rarely experienced down here. And they can provide a religious belief founded very much more than here upon living experience, and certainly less upon sheer blind faith. At this point, I think I ought to say that there is, however, no real permanence in any of these conditions and states of consciousness. Every normal person who dies a natural death passes through these worlds of emotion and mind with varying speeds until the center of life and awareness, which had been incarnated in the physical body, the spiritual soul, is withdrawn into its source. While there are, of course, exceptions, this must be taken as the general rule, and in the intermediate worlds, one sees people returning to their source with varying degrees of rapidity, according to the degree of spirituality or materialism in the character and interests of the deceased. The ideal, naturally, is not to remain in the intermediate worlds, which I've been partly describing to you, but to pass on as rapidly as possible through the worlds of emotion and analytical thought into the beatitude of the heaven life, and later to full reabsorption into the higher spiritual soul. There, and I've had to be brief, and I know I have left out a great deal, but there briefly are the theosophical answers to those questions. To what conditions does the soul awaken after death? Is there continuity of personality with memory, affection, sympathy, and continued interests? The answer was yes. And is there time, business, work, and pressure there? The answer, you remember, was no. These do not follow us when the body is laid aside. Now, another part of our question, another problem which faces us. Since bereavement is the certain lot of each and every one of us, it is inevitable that many times throughout our lives we should ask ourselves the question as to whether death means a final separation, or whether somehow and somewhere we and our loved ones will meet again. Theosophy has a great deal to say concerning this pressing human problem. Will we meet again, or does death bring the extinction of human identities and so the end of human relationships? Theosophy says quite definitely, those who love here will be reunited. Nothing, neither death nor rebirth, can break the bonds of true love. Love itself is indeed immortal, and is, moreover, the strongest force in the universe. Reunion is therefore utterly assured for all those who truly love. And remember that not only is there reunion after death, when two people die fairly nearly at the same time, but in our inner natures, in our true spiritual selves, we are always together. Whether we're in bodies or not in bodies, in our innermost essence, we belong to each other. We are attuned and we are always at one. And then still more, if one can believe in reincarnation, then the opportunity of a physical reunion is afforded by the possibility of rebirth in new bodies, when we may take up the story and the life of our love once again. Indeed, theosophy suggests, and by the by, none of its teachings are dogmatically affirmed, but theosophy suggests that in many cases of deep, true, and lasting love, the companionship is not new. Those who deeply love and often very soon after meeting are old loved ones who have been parted from former lives. Their love has drawn them together again, and they take up the beautiful story in their new lives. So in all of these ways, my friends, reunion between those who love is assured. Now let us continue our subject and answer some more of those questions. The gradual withdrawal from the material towards the more spiritual worlds, which normally begins at death, culminates in entry into perfect happiness and fulfillment. The state of supreme content is a heaven indeed, for in it every aspiration is fulfilled, every feeling of unselfish love is completely expressed, and this is the heaven to which all of us eventually will come. And in the heaven to which the departed withdraw in the second phase of the life after death, all loved ones are perceived as intimately present. All truth, all beauty, all peace, all love and happiness which the deceased is capable of experiencing, the soul, after its essential and fruitful and sometimes rather trying life on earth. Herein also we perceive the precise operation of a law of attraction and of cause and effect. For all experiences after death, and this should be remembered, all experiences after death are the effects of causes set going during earth life. Their richness is also exactly proportionate to the depth of the feelings which cause them, and the thoughts and aspirations. Everywhere, you know, and so both here and hereafter, there is exact law, the law of action and reaction, cause and effect, which ensures justice to every human being. A noble, kind, unselfish physical life is therefore the best preparation for the life after death. What then, and here's the answer to another of our questions, what should we offer to death? Certainly not fear. Rather a welcome, almost as if packing up for a holiday, some people say. A holiday after the strenuous but essential and valuable experiences of life here on earth. Someone, I forget whom, has in fact written concerning the near approach of death in these words. The soul is packing up and just on wing, like parting swallows when they seek the spring. Can one then make plans for one's life after the death of the body? The natural death, be it remembered. Certainly one can, for as I have just been saying, the law of cause and effect operates from physical to superphysical life, from life here to life hereafter. Each one of us, you and I, we are therefore continuously making our after-death conditions now. We're doing it by our daily thoughts, our motives and feelings and words and deeds. If we live nobly, beautifully and unselfishly while here on earth, we ensure for ourselves a corresponding measure of happiness after death. So you see, conditions are very largely in our own hands. So you see that in physical death there is nothing whatever to be afraid of. Rarely is an individual conscious of the final departure from the body. He slips away as in sleep, tranquilly, peacefully, and without pain, as many a physician will tell you. Death for most people is a release into a freer, happier life. Birth is not the beginning of human existence, and death is not its end. The body alone is born at physical birth. The body alone dies at physical death. I do hope that all who hear me will find themselves able to believe this truth. Let me repeat it. The body alone is born at physical birth. The body alone dies at physical death. Both birth and death are oft-recurring incidents in the long series of our earthly lives, those lives by means of which alone we are enabled to climb upwards to full spiritual knowledge of our true immortal selves, or in other words, to adeptship. For you know that true self, which is our real being, is immortal, undying. For us, then, there really is no death. Each one of us is an immortal son of God. Death exists only in the eye that beholds it, touching only the physical body. And when we are free from the physical body, death releases us in a large measure from its blinding power. The physical body and the matter of the physical world so often hide from us the spiritual realities which are all about us and within us, you know, just as the veil of day conceals the ever-shining stars. There, my friends, is the end of my talk to you on this particular and important subject of our life after death. I would like, before I really finish, to read you two very favorite short poems of mine about this subject. Here they are. One is by Robert Campbell McPhee, and it's called An Adventure. Robert Campbell McPhee writes, "What an adventure it will be to die, when the dark sky, rent like the petal of an opened rose, parts to disclose the golden heart of beauty at its core. What a divine adventure to explore the valley of the shadow, where the roar of life's red river gradually grows dumb, and darkness strangles us, and we become sightless and numb, nerveless and cold, feeling the dear familiar body torn, a robe outworn from the unmantled spirit, fold by fold. What an adventure it will be to die, and in a magic moment be reborn, passing unconsciously upon a sigh, from night to morn. To wake from sleep and find the eyes no longer blind, and like a sword unsheathed and bright and bare, the swift emancipate immortal mind, flashing and flaming in the ampler air." Isn't that a lovely poem? And so true. That is what we will find. Now, another one, rather shorter, by John Oxenham. "There is no death." And this will bring my talk to a close. "One said, it is death, and I, in weakness, slipping through the night, in summer fright, looked up, and lo, no spectre grim, but just a dim, sweet face, a sweet, high mother face, alight with tenderness and grace. Thou art not death," I cried, for life's supremest fantasy had never thus envisaged death to me. "Thou art not death, the end." In accents winning came the answer, "Friend, there is no death. I am the beginning, not the end."